All right, so the main thing that I'm going to need now that left over from the lecture this morning is I'll have H information matrix. And right, I can go that far down. I'll have H information matrix. And I've got this space GRK of CN is the set of all K planes in CN, and so k-dimensional subspaces of CN, and we noticed that corresponds to the orbit with the space of Hermitian matrices with this spectrum. But I'm going to think about it in this more linear algebra way and less matrix way from time to time. And let me now define, and using this Morse decomposition from the Rayleigh trace, but I guess I didn't use this notation before, so I am actually defining it. Let me define GRKCN, and then I'll have two indices. One will be the Hermitian matrix, and the other will be a subset I. I is from 1 up to n, and it's a size k. And this is going to be, well, it's going to be the things that flow down to the I coordinate space under, Rayleigh trace with respect to H. So let me say this is with simple spectrum. And so this is going to be only certain subspaces, only certain k-planes, and which ones? It's that the dimension of V intersected with the sum of H's I largest eigenspaces is more than the same intersection, but with I minus 1. All right, so let me give an example of that. what if H is 5, 4, 3, 2, negative 6? Okay, so H is a very easy matrix to think about, and it's got simple spectrum. And I'm going to look at V is going to be the three-plane vectors of the form A, 0, B, B, C. Okay? So you can tell when there's a vector in there, it's whether it looks like that, whether the second coordinate is 0 and the third and fourth coordinates are equal. So a three-dimensional space like that. It's just some three-plane. And I'm looking now at V intersected with the eigenspaces of this. So there's V intersect 0, and there's V intersect the 5 space. And there's V intersected with the 5 and 4 space, and with the 5, 4, and 3, and 5, 4, 3, and 2, and then with the whole thing. Okay, and this intersection, of course, is 0. And this intersection is vectors that look like this. Okay, so it's slightly larger. And this one is the same. Right? If I say I want to be of that form, I've got some constraints to be in V, and I'm constrained to be in here, then I don't get anything new that I didn't have already. This is letting me let the second coordinate be non-zero. but V itself is not letting the second coordinate be non-zero. Okay, so now I'm going to intersect V with this. So I'm going to take vectors that look like this and ask that the first three coordinates be zero. And I still get the same. So if I ask that the first three coordinates be zero, if I ask only the first three coordinates may be non-zero, but I also ask that the third and fourth coordinate agree, then it didn't help. Now I get something larger. I get A, 0, B, B, 0. So a two-dimensional space, and then I finally get V. So the dimensions here were 0 and 1 and 1 and 1 and 2 and 3. And so there was a jump here, and no jump, no jump, and then a jump, and then a jump. And the way I'm going to write that is I will say that this particular guy, V, was in which part of the Grassmannian? It's in H, comma, and then the subset will be, maybe I'll write it by the pattern of the jumps. 1, 0, 0, 1, 1. That's right. That's right. I've got this is more than that if and only if I is in big I. Thank you. So I want the jumps to occur exactly where big I says that they're supposed to be. So here, from here to here, there was a jump, then there wasn't, then there was. And so the jumps occurred in places 1, 4, and 5. So that's how I'm denoting this over here. Beginning, what do you mean? I mean, I'm looking at these intersections. For me, this is the beginning. Given H and V, I get I. You can say that. Or given H and I, there's many Vs, not just one. Well, there's infinitely many Vs. I mean, you could describe them all. They're the ones whose reduced row echelon form has pivots in the right columns. Okay. So what I need this for is for this lemma of Hirsch and Svalin from 62. And it comes back to something I had when I had the picture of the donut, which was that if you take your point and you flow down using gradient flow, then the original value of the function is bounded below by the limiting value of the function. And what that says in this context is that the Rayleigh trace, the trace of pi w times h, is bounded below by the sum over I and I of lambda I, and this is where a couple of things. One is that H has this spectrum, and W is in this piece of the Grassmannian. So W, what happens is the W flows downhill using the Rayleigh trace to a certain point. It flows down to being a coordinate subspace with respect to the coordinates we derive from H. So it's a sum of K of H's eigenspaces. It flows down to the point where it's the sum of K eigenspaces of H. And then this trace is just the sum of those K eigenvalues. And that's what we have here. Okay. And you can work with minus H instead, but then everything's sort of reversed, right? If you work with minus H, then you're adding up the eigenspaces. So when I'm adding these eigenspaces, I'd be working with the smallest eigenspaces of H if I work with the largest eigenspaces of minus H. Remember, I'm talking about largest and smallest by the eigenvalue, not by the dimension. All the dimensions are one. No.
Okay.
These are if.
Okay.
And this is then.
Oh, okay.
And it's not if and only if by any means. This is just a condition that that is true for everybody in. So if I took things in the Grassmannian in general, if I didn't know anything about where it was, then you would say this is bounded below by the sum of H's k smallest eigenvalues. But occasionally you can do better. If it's tightly related to H's large eigenspaces, then you can do better. Okay? So let's do the same thing with minus H. So with minus H, then W is going to be in the Grassmannian somewhere for minus H. There's going to be some other subsets. And we just apply the same thing again. And we have J in J. And now this is I'm taking the eigenvalues of minus H, which are not quite minus these. It's minus these in reverse. So minus lambda n plus 1 minus j. Right, so this statement already implies this one, but just for a different subset. So what I'm doing now is I'm doing gradient flow up, you might say. Before I thought, well, I'll take my point W and it'll flow down and it'll get stuck somewhere. But I could also imagine, why don't I flow up and see where it gets stuck. So it'll flow down to I, and it'll flow up to J. And I'll get...
Because I thought we specifically weren't taking the k smallest, but we were associating the lambda I with this set I.
Yes?
So I don't see why, when you have minus H, I could see why you renumber them if you were taking them in order, but I don't see why you renumber them if you're just taking J and J.
I am taking them in order. This theorem is stated only applies to take the eigenvalues of this matrix in decreasing order.
Oh.
And now this matrix is minus H. So I need the eigenvalues of minus H in decreasing order.
They're in decreasing order, but the I can look at. Okay, now I
can. So these numbers are now in decreasing order because of the minus and because I flipped them. Right, so this, of course, we can rewrite. This is that the trace of pi wh is bounded above by sum over j and j, lambda n plus 1 minus j. Okay, so... what can you do with this? So here's the theorem that's going to start answering. We can do this. I can say what the question is first. So Weil asks the following question: knowing the spectrum or the spectra of two Hermitian matrices, and I'll just call them H lambda and H mu, and then you know what their spectra are too. They're lambda and mu. What are the possible spectra of H lambda plus H mu? And if you want, you could insist that H lambda is diagonal, right? You could hit all three of these by the same unitary matrix, so as to make H lambda be diagonal with decreasing entries. And H mu, you couldn't ask to be simultaneously diagonal with that. I'm not saying that H lambda and H mu commute. If they do, then it's pretty easy to get some answers, some possibilities that you know must be there. You'll take lambda and add to it some permutation of mu, and that's probably not in decreasing order, so you rearrange it to be in decreasing order, and that's one of the possible answers to this. And you could then guess, oh, maybe I should just take the convex hull of that like I did before, and that doesn't get you everything. There's more possibilities. But this is Weyl's question. So let me give you the sure side of things, the necessary conditions, for necessary conditions on this on the three spectra here. We know lambda, we know mu. What are the possible nu? Or you can always ask it, right? If I know lambda and nu, which mu could have gotten there? Just conditions that relate the three spectra. Here's a theorem. And so this is in Johnson's unpublished thesis from 79. And then many others from 93 to 95. One being Kliatchko. It was then years later that this thing was unearthed from, and so Johnson left mathematics, and, you know, I've tried to find him, but it's very hard to find Johnson, right? It's easy to find Johnsons, but...
So it's not the Johnson of Horton Johnson, in the first
book. It is, I don't think so. This is a student, guy's name I forget at Santa Barbara.
Thompson,
yeah, Bob Thompson.
What's the first name of the Johnson
here? Stephen? Pretty sure. What he proves is if there exists I'm going to write the word magic just because you shouldn't have any reason to believe it. Yes? Right, and there are many possibilities, but not everything is possible. So it's the same level of, it's the same sort of question as before. If I know only the spectrum of H lambda, then I can ask, what could the diagonal possibly be? And now, what could the spectrum possibly be? So you might say it instead as, I'm going from O lambda cross O mu to Rn, taking H lambda, H mu, to the spectrum of H lambda plus H mu. And it's not really Rn it's going to. It's Rn where the entries are decreasing. And you can ask, what's the image of that? So one thing that's a little different about, before I get into the theorem, I say one thing that's a little different about this map is that it's continuous, but it's not differentiable. When the eigenvalues start to coincide, then this map isn't differentiable. And so that means it's harder to apply simple calculus arguments to it. But that's actually what Horn did when he thought about this question. So I'll tell you some of that too. Anyway, so if there exists a magic subspace, W, such that W is a k-dimensional subspace. Such that W is in it's in a certain position with respect to H lambda's eigenspaces. I'll say it's in the I position, okay? And it also is in a certain position with respect to H mu's eigenspaces, say the J position, and it's in a certain Schubert position with respect to minus H lambda minus H mu, K. Right? So what are these guys? here, I, J, and K are all subsets of 1 up to N, and all of the same size. Okay? So if I have a W that intersects H lambda's big eigenspaces a lot, and H mu's big eigenspaces a lot, but it intersects their sums small eigenspaces a lot, you might say. If you have such a thing, then you can derive an inequality. Then, if you sum these eigenvalues of lambda and these eigenvalues of mu, then that's bounded above by the sum of, well, I guess I already used little k for the dimension, so I'll use little l now. And this is the lth eigenvalue of h lambda plus h mu. Right? And so let me give an example. Before I write down the proof, let me say one example of an inequality you probably know like this, which is the smallest eigenvalue of the sum is at least the sum of the two smallest eigenvalues. So that says that that if I is just n, the smallest, so I just have lambda n here and mu n here, the smallest two eigenvalues, that will bound below the smallest eigenvalue of the sum.
So we have go through all possible k. K, small k from 1 to n. H mu,
Eventually, I will want to get all possible. I'm only doing one direction right now. I'm only saying if I have a magic subspace, then I get an inequality. Then there will be statements about if you take all of the inequalities, you get that way. But I'm not doing that direction yet.
Sure. Yeah. As a follow on, every subspace W will satisfy these conditions for some
subspace. I, J, and K.
And J and K, right?
So that's right.
Every subspace W is going to give you a condition.
Yes, but most of those conditions are dumb. If you take a generic W, then it doesn't intersect lambda's big eigenspaces very much. And so you get something like the smallest eigenvalues here plus the smallest eigenvalues there are bounded above by the k largest eigenvalues there. So that's what happens for generic W. Yeah. So the whole interest is in finding very special W that managed to satisfy these conditions very specially. I could say also, one can compute the number of degrees of freedom of these three spaces, you know, or of each of these spaces, and it's I'll tell you in a few minutes. But the dimension of the whole Grassmannian, if you want to tell somebody a k-dimensional space, an n-space, you'd give them a basis, and then you could, so that would be a K by N matrix. And that's too big. That's too much information. That would be K. So that makes it sound like the dimension of the Grassmannian is something like K times N. But it's actually K times N minus K squared, because you have this UK that lets you cancel off the effect of choosing that basis. So one can compute the dimension of this whole thing, and then one can compute the dimensions of these smaller things and say, how restrictive is it to say that I'm in here, and then in there, and in there, to demand all those things at the same time? And eventually you want it to be as restrictive as possible to get the most interesting W. And I'll say more about that. Okay, so I have an inequality to derive, and as I said, it's usually a boring inequality, but we'll find out that we'll get many interesting ones too. Okay, so the proof is we start with the trace of pi w times h lambda plus the trace of pi w times h mu is equal to the trace of pi w times h lambda plus h mu. So this trace is additive. And this is bounds above sum over I and I of the lambda I. And this And this bounds above sum over J and J of mu J. And now I'm using the other one. This is bounded above by sum over L and K. And what I meant, I said Lth eigenvalue, and I left out the word smallest. That's what I wanted. Lth smallest eigenvalue. So to get this inequality the wrong direction, it's from using this second one. And that's the proof. All right, so that doesn't sound very constructive, that how would you find these W? But it, actually, this is exactly how the literature progressed for 50 years or so. Weil himself writes down a one-dimensional space, so little k equals 1, that gets him the Weil inequalities. And so the Weil inequalities are that lambda I plus mu j is bounded above by lambda, I'm going to call it nu, I should have done that before, nu I plus j minus 1, and I want a greater than or equal there. Okay. Now, I should apologize, this is not quite the same as these, because I've got a less than equal here and a greater than equal there, but you can use the trace to turn a less than equal into a greater than equal. The sum of all the lambdas plus all the mu's definitely equals the sum of all of these. So you can subtract this from, or you could subtract that from the equation trace plus trace equals trace to get one of those. And he does this by constructing a certain subspace, a certain magic W. And then people constructed lots of other clever ones. And how do they construct them? They start with the flag associated with h lambda and h mu and minus h nu. So I said before how given a Hermitian matrix, you get a chain of subspaces. And you can use those subspaces in clever ways. You can intersect them and add them together and intersect them again and add them together. And you can construct lots and lots, infinitely many other subspaces of Cn using those 3n subspaces that come from h lambda, h mu, and minus h mu. And that's what people did. They wrote down these very complicated ways of constructing a subspace and proved inequalities like this. And they did that before the Hirsch-Fallon theorem, but that's what they were secretly doing. Okay, I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to tell you how to know that such a W exists without finding one. So the idea is to guarantee existence of W by topological means. So let's go back to the donut. Let's say that I tell you I've got a couple of curves on the donut. This one and this one. And notice that those curves intersect at this point. So the idea you should have in mind is that the donut is my picture of the Grassmannian, and these curves are my pictures of these guys, these subsets of the Grassmannian, called Bruha cells on the Grassmannian. And what I want to know is, I want to know there's a W that lies on the intersection. I want to know there's a W doing all those things at the same time. Okay, so looking at this picture, well, you say, okay, there's the intersection. And I say, okay, close your eyes, and while your eyes are closed, I'm going to wiggle the yellow one around, and it'll be over here now. And I'm going to wiggle the red one. And I ask you, can I get them separated? No. No matter how I wiggle them, as long as I don't break them, I can't get the yellow and the red one disentangled on this surface. So the idea is, by showing that these three pieces, the I, J, and K conditions, can't be disentangled. Maybe I shouldn't use the word entangle in this audience. But when you think entangle in my lecture, you should think of a picture like this. That these two, that I can wiggle the yellow, I can wiggle the red, but I can't get them to not intersect. And, you know, you can sort of think of it as, right now they're intersecting once. And I could wiggle it so that, oh, let's say they intersect three times, but I can't wiggle it so that they intersect an even number of times, such as zero. I mean, you can get, unless one's tangent to the other, and I'll just count that as not intersecting. So, that's not really a proof as to why you can't get them disentangled, but it's a reasonable way to think about it. Okay, well, this doesn't seem to have helped matters unless I tell you how to compute and say when I, J, and K, when is it that they can't be disentangled? And I'll tell you that now. Actually, before that, let me tell you a little more of the history of this problem. So I've told you some necessary conditions on lambda mu and nu, where nu is the spectrum of their sum. So what are some related theorems? Well, the interesting one is, So first, Horn, and this is in 1962, says it's enough to consider the case that the set of W is finite. So if you think about I, J, and K, let's say you have some I, J, and K, and you find out, yes, there's a W. In fact, there's a five-parameter family of such Ws. Then don't bother. You could do better. Okay. So you could say, well, let's tighten up I, let's tighten up J, let's move to larger eigenvalues here, or maybe smaller eigenvalues there, and I'll get a better inequality, and I'll have fewer Ws that do it, but there will still be Ws that do it. So you can get down to the case where there's only you only need to consider the triples IJK on which there is a finite number of W's. So the big theorem here, of course, is Kliachko from, I think one version I find is 93, but maybe Sasha can correct me. Which is that these conditions are also sufficient. So that may not sound as impressive as it should be, because I haven't told you really how to find out when these W exist, but I promise we'll be there very soon. And so now, once we have a reasonable computational way of listing the triples IJK that have finitely many W, then the fact that those are all the conditions is the important theorem here. So another theorem, Bell-Colley from 99, is it's enough to take those IJK for which W is unique. So this is even better than Horn's theorem. Horn says you may as well get down to finitely many, and there will be cases where there will be exactly two. And if there are exactly two, skip them. They are, you could do better somewhere else. And one more theorem here. Me and Terry Tao and Chris Woodward from this century is that you can't shorten that list. So all the inequalities that are on Bell-Colley's list, you need them all. So just to say what that means, if I want to tell somebody that I'm thinking about the first quadrant, I could tell them x is more than 0, and y is more than 0, and x plus y is more than 0. And those inequalities are all true. And this is a necessary and sufficient list. Excuse me, this is a necessary and sufficient list of conditions to be in the quadrant. But you don't really need this one, because it's implied by the others. So if you take the ones where there's too many W's, then this derivation is still fine, and you'll get a true inequality. But you can get rid of all those inequalities without changing the solution set until you get down to here. And now these are all necessary. Every one of these defines something, defines an actual wall of the polyhedron of solutions. Okay, so what are they? I do. I do. I mean, you have to be a little careful what you mean. That's the best list if you want to think about all lambda, mu, and nu at the same time. If you say, here's my lambda and mu, what are the possible nu, then it may be shorter. But for every inequality, there will be some lambda, some mu, for which you'll need that that inequality. I'm talking about a list of linear inequalities. You could not make it a shorter list of linear inequalities. Exponential. No, I can't. I remember seeing a lower bound at some point saying it was at least exponential. But remind me to talk about something like that at some point. I'll remember. Just give me a keyword and I'll know what to do. Okay. So you can ask. Let's say, given I and J, for which I and JK and generic H lambda and H mu, are there a finite set of W? And how many? Of course, we're mainly interested in the case where there's one, but I'll tell you in general how many there are. So let me define a puzzle piece. D there's this puzzle piece, it's an equilateral triangle with zeros on the edges. And you're going to confuse yourself if you draw it like that. Don't do that. Put the zeros on the edges. And there's this puzzle piece with ones on the edges. And there's this one, which is two equilateral triangles put together with ones here and zeros here. And you're allowed to rotate these. But you're not allowed to reflect them. So those are the three kinds of puzzle pieces. And we define a puzzle as a bunch of puzzle pieces put together into a big triangle. Okay, so for example, let's say that I already know my puzzle has these values around this part. And I say, well, what could the rest of the puzzle look like insofar as it's made of those puzzle pieces? Well, this part, so I'm going to fill it from the top down because that's where I have the most information. So up here, this guy doesn't fit and that guy doesn't fit. It's got to be that one. Okay? And here it's got to be this first one. And here it's got to be that one. Okay? And at this point, actually, there's two possibilities for how to keep filling. So I'm going to choose one of them. I'll put a 1 here. You could also put a 0 there and it would work, but I'll put a 1. And then this forces that. And now this is a rotation of the third guy. It's this rotation. And these ones force that I have this rotation of that. And now that gets me here, and I'll use lots of experience with puzzles to fill this in quickly. Let me say, if you want to do these things by yourself, and who could blame you, the thing to know is that when you want to fill in this, when you want to fill in something with a 60-degree turn, then it's unique what you could possibly put in. But if you have 120 degrees, then if there's zeros here, you get a 0 in between. If there's ones here, you get a 1 in between. If there's a 0 and a 1, then it has to be that rhombus. And if it's a 1 and a 0, then there's a choice. So either you could have a 1 here and you get a rhombus coming this way, or you put a 0 here and you get a rhombus going down that way. Okay? So if you want to do this on your own, this speeds things up a fair bit. And the theorem that's in that same paper is that the number of W is equal to the number of puzzles with I here and J there and K there. And that's if finite. And if it's infinite, then there are no puzzles. So it automatically doesn't work when you wouldn't want it to work, when you wouldn't want to bother.
Well, I think I is the sequence of 1 and 0.
That's right. Yeah, back with, yeah.
You could have the K going in the opposite direction with the reverse rhombus.
Right, but it's it works most nicely this way. Not the reverse rhombus. Let me give an example. That puzzle, the one I drew over there, leads to the inequality. So I look at this and I say, where are the ones on this side? Where are the ones on that side? Where are the ones on this side? And on one side I get lambda 2 plus lambda 4 because I've got 1s in the second and fourth position. And then I've got plus mu 2 plus mu 4, so I've got the 1s in the second and fourth position. Again, read this way, right? That sum is less than equal to, and here I've got the 1s in the first and last position, nu 1 plus nu 4. So given a puzzle, if you can write down a puzzle, the puzzle gives you an inequality on sums of Hermitian matrices. But there might be more than one puzzle with the same boundary, in which case you should ignore that inequality because you can do better. That's right. So it'll get you a true inequality, but there are better inequalities out there. So the smallest such puzzle is a size 6. And so you can go out and find the first puzzle boundary that can be filled in two different ways. No, that was with just I and J. Once I made that choice, that fixed K. So there is another way of filling this in with the same I and J. But then the K at the bottom will be 0, 1, 1, 0. And there's a cheap trick to find that one. Take this guy, flip it over, which I told you not to do, but then switch zeros for ones everywhere, and you get the other puzzle. Yeah?
I'm a little bit troubled by talk about generic Hermitian matrices. If wild inequality is true for all Hermitian matrices, are you saying that it is true sort of with probability 1? Or?
Yes. So the point is that you can have very special Hermitian matrices where there would then be infinitely many W's. So I only want to count the number of W's in the general in this generic case.
Oh, but if there are infinitely many W's, that is infinitely many magic W's,
mm-hmm.
then the corresponding inequality is still true.
Right. I'm just saying that puzzles won't compute it. This puzzles is only good in this generic case. Puzzles will not tell you if you have special H lambda and H mu how many W's there are. They can only tell you how many W's there are in the generic case. Yep.
Probably connected to this. All the time as you're presenting here, I'm thinking, gee, this would look so much nicer if instead of talking about H lambda and H mu and then sum, you would talk about three matrices.
Adding to zero. Yes.
But then there's a difference because
then you read this the other direction.
Generic and the third one is not generic or something.
It's generic enough. It doesn't lead to anything different at all. The only difference is that then instead of having an inequality lambda and mu less than equal nu, I would have a much nicer looking inequality lambda and mu and plus nu less than equal zero all put together. And the only difference would be that instead of reading this way, I would read it the other way. And so absolutely you're right. It's nicer to do the symmetric formulation. And I mostly did that in the papers, but this is the one I'm going to need for the next problem. Yep.
So what if K is equal to 1? What are all the vowel typing?
Right. So if K equals 1, what does a puzzle look like? So it's got a 1 here somewhere, and a 1 here somewhere, and a 1 here somewhere, and all these zeros. And what that 1 does, okay, this is not... Let me put this up there. So what that one does is it starts this little chain of rhombi to there. So I have a bunch of these rhombi. And then I get a 1-1-1 triangle. And coming off of that 1-1-1 triangle, there's another chain of rhombi coming out here and another chain of rhombi coming out there. And these are all just zero triangles, and I've got these rhombi and these rhombi. So this is the puzzle picture of Weyl's inequalities. Yeah.
So
what
that means is that Weyl's inequalities are true, but no similar inequalities are, unless they can be derived.
There are no more inequalities that only involve a single eigenvalue from each of the matrices. That's right. Okay. So let me sum this up. The statement. So I'm going to put together the puzzles and this and tell you what the exact statement is about Weyl's problem. Oh, I've got a ring. So together, one, each puzzle gives an inequality on Hermitian sums to only rigid puzzles are necessary. They give the exact list of linear inequalities on this problem. So let me say, this question about computing the number of subspaces satisfying a bunch of intersection conditions, that is Schubert calculus. And Schubert worked on exactly this in the 19th century and said, I'd like to know how many subspaces. For example, Schubert asks, how many lines are there that touch four lines in space? So I've got a line here and another line here, and I say, oh, I want to think about lines that touch both of these. And so that means that it's some point on here and some point on there. Okay, so that's, I've still got 2 degrees of freedom. Now I also want my line to intersect over here, and I also want it to intersect over there. Okay, so that's 4 conditions now, and you can check that, and each time you put on a condition, you cut down a degree of freedom. So I've now got 0 degrees of freedom. You expect there should be finitely many lines that touch the 4 of these. And the answer is there are 2. And how do you compute that with puzzles? You say, let's put on this, which says I've got a condition on my line. It touches another line. And it should touch another line. And then it should touch another line. And then it should touch another line. And you count how many ways to fill this in, and there are 2. So Schubert didn't work with puzzles. The puzzles are Mai and Terry's invention. But he gave this calculational method to work out these numbers for large dimensional questions, and it wasn't a positive rule. I mean, you know in advance the number is going to be 0 or positive. It's not going to be that there's -5 lines that do this. So if you follow his calculational techniques, you say, okay, so the number of lines that satisfy these conditions is 1 minus 32 plus 65 minus 58, blah, blah, blah. And you get this thing, and it's hard to tell when it's 0 and when it's positive. Here it's easy. You say, is there a puzzle or not? If you write down the puzzle, nobody can take it away from you. There isn't another minus term that will cancel off that puzzle. So there's other positive ways of computing the number of W's. And the best known one is the Littlewood-Richardson rule, which is in terms of Young tableau. And you can correspond the Littlewood-Richardson rule with this rule. I like this one much more for a number of reasons I could tell you about. But I think this is as much as I'm going to tell you about puzzles. There are so many theorems one can prove just about the puzzles just from this definition that you can give to high school students to prove. And then not tell them, oh, but it's so that you can derive inequalities on Hermitian matrices. And I'll stop there for today.